My guest is Junius Irving Scales, the only American to be convicted and imprisoned for being a member of the Communist Party. He was convicted under the Smith Act, a 1940 law that made it a felony to advocate or belong to a group which advocated the violent overthrow of the United States government. Scales' attorney for his appeal was Telford Taylor, who was the chief Allied prosecutor at the Nuremberg War Crimes Trial. Celebrities like Paul Robeson, Eleanor Roosevelt, and New York Post editor James Wexler came to Scales' defense, seeing in his case a test of the principles protecting free speech. Scales served 15 months in prison before President Kennedy commuted his sentence on Christmas Eve of 1962. Junius Irving Scales has written an account of his experiences in the Communist Party. It's titled Cause at Heart, and it's published by the University of Georgia Press. Scales quit the party in 1957 after the Stalin revelations. After his release from prison, he worked as a proofreader for the New York Times, a position he recently retired from. He co-authored his book with a longtime friend named Richard Nixon, who is, by the way, not the former president. As a matter of fact, he spells his name N-I-C-K-S-O-N, just to clear up any confusion. Junius Irving Scales, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Did you go through many years of not talking about your past with new friends and colleagues?
Yes, I left the party 30 years ago, and I left prison about 24 years ago. And after I got out of prison, I did a lot of wound licking and self-examining and trying to analyze what had happened to me, and trying to break the grip of an ideology that's very consuming. So I stayed pretty much to myself and my family, and I was not active in politics from the time I got out of prison, at least not particularly active.
But I guess you're ready to tell your story now.
Yes, I feel the time has come. My friend and co-author Richard Nixon was urging me that an unexamined life is not worth the living, and besides that, the 40 years of anti-communist stereotype that we've been subjected to during the Cold War is so, it's gotten to such an absurd level that it makes most communists thought to be something like a cross between mental patients and the Ku Klux Klan or something, running around plotting and talking about the need for violence and force. And it got a little much, and I decided I would tell my own story and try to tell it straight, and that would in some way counter the anti-communist stereotype that's been so prevalent for so long.
Let's talk about your story. You joined the Communist Party when you were still in college, and you were very excited about the ideals it represented to you. And I should mention here that you were from a very prosperous Southern family. Tell us about the ideals that you saw in the Communist Party that you wanted to work for yourself.
Well, see, I was growing up in the 30s. I was not politically inclined at all. And the rise of fascism was terrifying, and it was most of us sensed instinctively that we were going to be in the war before too long. And I was so sheltered that I didn't realize just what was going on around me. I didn't realize that I'd only known blacks as servants. I'd never known Negroes socially, and the same was true of white workers. And when I, by some chance encounters, I began to discover black students and white workers, and I was so overwhelmed by how isolated I'd been that I got terribly excited about the poverty that existed then. This was the South that Roosevelt spoke of as the nation's number one economic problem. The most miserable section of the economy, and so on. And this was a terrible time, and it was a terrible society. It was the variant of apartheid. The main difference being that in the South, the blacks were a minority instead of a majority. But all of the degradation, all of the discriminatory viciousness was there.
But joining the party, you saw that as a way to work for racial equality and also to be a union organizer.
Yes, you see, the party had an approach to everything that concerned me deeply. They were profoundly anti-fascist. They had sent the Abraham Lincoln Battalion to Spain, and I wanted to go, but I discovered about it too late. And the party were the most active organizers of the poorest workers and put their money where their mouth was. Some of my friends were almost killed in their efforts to organize unorganized workers. And so I met student communists who, and oh, that was the principal thing was that on the Negro question, liberals were wavering and trying to work within the policy of segregation. They were saying that it's just got to be more equal, but you couldn't have equality and segregation, as everyone realized by the end of the war, but a lot of liberals stayed the same, you know, and just accepted the separate part of the equation.
When you first joined the party, did you find that your fellow students or friends or neighbors distrusted you because you were publicly a communist?
Well, I wasn't publicly a communist then. This was, you know, 1939. Well, it's I still have people who are castigating me for not being a public communist from the beginning, but that's like asking me to put my head in a buzzsaw, because if I had proclaimed myself a public communist in 1939, I'm sure I'd have been run out of school. I would have been victimized in every possible way, and my life would have been in danger. Now the question is, is it deception when you don't say that you're? I didn't say I wasn't a communist, but I didn't say I was. You know, that was the whole business. And I, until 1947, I never proclaimed myself publicly a communist. I took positions that I believed in, but I never stated I was a communist publicly until 1947. Then the Cold War was beginning, and things looked so bad that I decided I would. I was a reasonably respectable veteran, and I decided I would simply come out and be a spokesman for the party and try to counter some of the crazy attacks.
Well, you rose quickly through the ranks, and you became the principal organizer for a region that covered around four or five states, North and South Carolina, Tennessee, Mississippi. But after you became a leader, you thought that the party started to deteriorate, and this was in the late 40s. You were especially describing about that, a certain paranoia, a constant search for weak links and rotten apples within the organization. Were there things that you were called on to do as a leader that you really didn't want to do, but you did out of a sense of obligation because you were expected to do it for the party?
There were all sorts of things. The party got terribly – this was after 1948 when they – Progressive Party came along. The party threw itself into the Progressive Party, and it was a disaster. And following that, instead of trying to seek out the reasons for the debacle, the tendency was to turn inward and look for the causes for the defeat in ourselves. So we started all kinds of security checks, and I was instructed to ask the most incredible personal questions of each member and so on. And I was also told to drop from the party all homosexuals and so on. And this was before I was the chairman then, but the district organizer was who was the responsible, the number one person. And I talked it over, and we found that the people that who had in this secret inquiry that I had to conduct, who had told me that they were homosexual or bisexual, you know, here these were people who were supposed to be dropped because they weren't so good security risks, and yet they were so courageous that they didn't have any hesitation of telling me that they were homosexual, and we thought about it, and we decided just to disregard that instruction, and we We simply ignored it, but we had an awful lot of digging into ourselves.
I think there were other things that made you uncomfortable. For instance, the language that the party literature was written in.
Yes, that was always a problem. It was so cliche ridden. You see, everything had to be oriented to the Soviet Union. We thought the Soviet Union was the socialist model. We thought it was the ultimate example of morality in international affairs and in internal affairs, and practically all of our literature had to stick in something about the Soviet Union, and also we fell into such terrible cliches. We fell into it sounded like a screaming, abrasive tone to it. And it was quite unreadable stuff, just very offensive.
Well, these are important things that you disagreed with, that the party was doing, expelling homosexuals and expecting leaders like you to actually do the expelling. And, you know, you didn't like the way the literature was written. How did you keep up with the party in spite of the differences that you had with it? What kept you working there?
Well, really, what happened is that I thought then and I think now that the people... the people I worked with in the party were just about the finest human material I've ever encountered, and they were earnest, honest, and dedicated, and they believed in what they were doing. And the fundamental thing was that in the South, racism was so pervasive, so overwhelming, and so corrosive that you either fought it consciously or you just closed your eyes, blinked, let it wash over you. But whatever you did, if you didn't fight it, you were corroded to a degree by it, and it was just insufferable. And all of us had that commitment. All of us felt the same dedication to do what we could to rouse white people, and to the outrages committed every day against Negro people, and to eliminate the racist laws that were on the books. Where this was just something that brought us terribly close together, and it made us, we just couldn't leave, you know.
In 1951, the party asked you to go underground. This is a period when I guess most of the leaders in the party were being tailed by the FBI.
Yes,
and
me included.
Yeah, you say you always had people following you. Mm. What did it mean to be an underground party leader? First of all, what work were you expected to do?
Well, by 51, I was married and had a small daughter, and the FBI just simply, they inhabited every house on the street I lived in, and anyone who came to see me was tailed, and they had telescopes focused on my house, and everyone that came and went was noted and photographed. And so it got so it became very difficult for me to meet with people at all. So I had to leave home. I would stay with friends, frequently non-party friends, and I would sometime I would stay in third-rate hotels and
under assumed names.
I had a code, so I would remember what name I'd used where, and. I traveled usually at night. I would travel at night. First of all, it saved the payment for a night's lodging, and I was less likely to be observed in the dark. So I would hole up in some place and meet with people individually or with twos and threes. And that was what underground meant. There was nothing very spectacular. In fact, it was a pretty deadly wearing routine.
It meant being separated from your family
all
the time.
And it meant I was able to see my family first maybe once a month and then once in 6 weeks, and then finally it got to about once in 3 months, and it was just intolerable.
Well, you were arrested while you were underground, and I want to ask you about that in a moment. But first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Junius Irving Scales, who is actually the only American to ever serve time in prison solely on the grounds of being a member of the Communist Party. He was indicted under the Smith Act, and he's written a memoir about his years as a party leader and his time in prison. And that book has just been published. It's called Cause at Heart. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Junius Irving Scales is my guest. He's written a new memoir titled Cause at Heart, A Former Communist Remembers. So you were underground with the Communist Party, going from city to city, organizing, and you were arrested in that capacity.
Yes.
Would you describe what it was like? You were walking down the street when suddenly you were overcome by the FBI?
Well, the FBI knew that I was coming to Memphis, and they had two informers in the party, and these two informers told them where I would be precisely at what time, and they were supposed to meet me. And they were doing their level best to arrest me before that rendezvous because that would expose their two informants, and they weren't able to do it. I evaded them by a whole bunch of routine maneuvers that I usually performed. And when I got three blocks from the rendezvous, an FBI man got on the trolley that I was riding, and I knew immediately. I just something crossed in our eyes, and I knew he was an FBI man, that I was spotted. So then it was a matter. I said, "Well, they know I'm here." So I got off the bus a block beyond the rendezvous spot. I walked around. It was beginning to pour. A thunderstorm came up, and it was getting dark, and it was there were FBI cars all down these blocks, a very quiet residential neighborhood, and it was quite a. It was the question was, would they arrest me, or would they just make my trip useless by following me so closely I couldn't go anywhere? I figured with the numbers they had, they were probably going to arrest me. So, as the rain started, I tore up a whole lot of papers, a lot of phony identity material, and so on, and also records that I didn't want them to see. So I tore them up in little pieces and put them down the storm sewer as the rain came, and then I walked toward the rendezvous, and at precisely the time, 7:30 p.m., I hit the intersection, and about car doors opened every place, and a crowd of men waving guns and hopped out of their cars saying, "We got you, Scales," and that was my arrest.
Well, you, I believe, had trouble finding a lawyer to represent you. Now, the lawyer for your appeal was Telford Taylor, who was a lawyer on the Nuremberg trials. And he insisted on representing you as an individual, and he wouldn't have represented you if it meant representing the Communist Party. Why did he make that distinction? Why was that important to him?
Well, I think he wanted to have control over the case, and he didn't want to be dealing with any committee. And I think he felt that he was representing an individual, and didn't consider that he'd be representing the party, which was reasonable enough and was agreeable to me.
Your former lawyer, Telford Taylor, explains in the preface of your book that most of the people who were arrested and tried under the Smith Act were really tried for the clauses that prohibit distributing literature that advocates the violent overthrow of the United States or for conspiring to overthrow the government of the United States. But only a handful of people were actually arrested and charged with being a member of a group that advocates the violent overthrow of the United States. And because you were one of the handful that were arrested under that clause and the only person who was actually convicted under it, your trial took on a lot of significance.
Well, yes, they tried to do was to say that membership involved conspiracy, but of course that wasn't written into the law. This was an afterthought on the part of the prosecution, and what they did the usual Smith Act business of getting professional witnesses who were in the pay of the Justice Department, who'd get on the stand and rattle on for a couple of days at a time, citing this piece of literature Marx said in 1800 and something and Lenin said in 1913 and Stalin said in 1921, and all of this stuff I was responsible for it because I had either sold it or this individual witness claimed that he had been taught that in a Communist Party school or something, you know, had been told to read this literature and so on. So all that made me responsible for everything ever written in over a period of many decades about the communist theory. So what you had was a table full of books piling up as they would cite this particular work and that particular work. And it was an absolutely bewildering thing. No jury could know what was going on. They hadn't the foggiest notion of what it was all about. They never produced a shred of evidence that I had ever done anything remotely resembling or advocating violence, I'd ever done anything subversive of the welfare of the country. That wasn't even the issue.
I'd like you to read the statement that you made at your first trial, to read an excerpt of that.
Oh, yes. Well, this was after I'd been convicted and sentenced to 6 years, and before sentencing, I had the opportunity to address the court, and I said, "Your Honor, I'm innocent of the charge in this case. Insofar as the issues are Marxism-Leninism and my beliefs, I do not think they can be tried in a courtroom, but must be tested in the give and take of political life. No jury is competent to convict a man for his ideas, no matter how long a study they make. This jury had small opportunity to even understand my ideas through these rags and tatters of unfamiliar books, introduced and grossly misrepresented by the government. For all the world, this has been like a medieval heresy trial. Mr. Stanley," that was the prosecutor, "asked the jury to drive communism out of North Carolina. He disagrees with my views on Negro equality, on foreign policy, on unions, and on many other things. The democratic thing would be to encourage debate on such ideas in public forums. Mr. Stanley asks that my ideas be jailed with me."
Now, it's interesting that not too long after you read that statement, your ideas about the party changed. After the Stalin revelations, you quit the party, and I think for so many people who had been in the Communist Party, it was just absolutely defeating, traumatizing to find out what had been happening in the Soviet Union. You quit the party when you found out about Stalin.
Well, not immediately. We were so horrified to find out that Khrushchev had said that everything we had denied for years and everything that we had said in praise of the Soviet Union and Stalin and the Soviet Party was absolutely false. We were 180 degrees wrong, and we had it from the horse's mouth, so to speak. Khrushchev himself told us. Well, it was devastating.
Well, this is always an occasion when something like this happens to totally reexamine your ideals and your politics. Did these revelations change your ideals and your politics?
Well, it didn't change my ideals because we'd put up a heck of a fight for Negro rights. We had done our darndest in organizing the unorganized. We had a tremendous local that we were largely responsible for organizing of 10,000 tobacco workers. We had done a lot of really fine things. We'd done a lot of stupid things, and we undid a lot of what we had done that was good because of our doctrinaire nonsense and our subservience, you know, our praise-making of the Soviet Union. So it caused us to, I think most of us were just about ready to throw Marxism-Leninism out of the window in pretty short order, and decided that it was pretty much what Lenin's vicar on earth in Moscow said it was on a given day, and we were so sick over that we just we were ready to call it quits.
Well, I guess here's what I really want to know: you served 15 months of a 6-year sentence, and then President Kennedy commuted your sentence. So you got out of jail after 15 months in jail. You had quit the party once you found out about Stalin. You had kept your ideals about racial equality and the importance of unions. Did you want to remain politically active once you got out of prison? Your ideals were the same, but you could no longer belong to the party. I don't know if you felt that you could act on your ideals anymore, but you weren't abandoning those ideals, so what did you do?
Well, of course, the thing that really clinched it was when after the Khrushchev revelations, the Hungarian revolution took place, and Soviet troops marched into Budapest, and Soviet tanks were shooting down workers in the street. So that iced the cake for us and for most of us. About 80% of the party left at that time. And
but I guess, have you been politically active since? Yeah. Since quitting the party?
No, I haven't been, because I pretty much lost confidence in my judgment on a great many things. And I've spent an awful lot of time of licking wounds and self-examination. And I didn't feel qualified to do much in the way of giving political leadership to anyone else. And I didn't trust my own ability to be effective for a great many years.
We only have about a minute left. I guess you actually kept a very low profile. You went to work as a proofreader for the New York Times in a kind of blue-collar job, the kind of work that you'd been working with blue-collar workers all your adult life. Now that you've written the book, do you feel like a different chapter in your life is going to open up?
Yes, I have a lot off my mind, I think, and I feel that I hope that this book will be a legacy that'll be worth something to those I leave behind.
Has it changed you to allow yourself to think again about periods that it seems to me you maybe have been trying to forget?
Oh yes, I've gotten out from the grip of my ideology, and I'm even ready to do battle with other ideologies, such as the ideology of anti-communism, which dominates our country these days. And that's what I hope this book will do for me.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. Thanks for being here. Thanks for coming. My guest has been Junius Irving Scales, who's written a memoir about his years as a leader in the South in the Communist Party, and about his imprisonment for being a member of the Communist Party. His book is called Cause at Heart, A Former Communist Remembers. It's published by the University of Georgia Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.